Okay, as I think all of you likely know, just about a year ago this week, the first cases of 2009 H1N1 influenza were reported to CDC. And in June, WHO raised the pandemic level alert to level 6. And very early on in the outbreak, we had some evidence that pregnant women were at increased risk. So cases reported to CDC in the first month of the outbreak showed that pregnant women had about 4 times the hospitalization rate as the general population, and that there were a disproportionate number of deaths among pregnant women. Historically, we have seen this same pattern in both pandemics that have occurred previously and in seasonal influenza. Pregnant women have an increased risk of complications and death. And here's a study that looked at women in the 3 trimesters of pregnancy and looked at risk of hospital admission for any respiratory illness during the influenza season. And they compared these women to the year prior to pregnancy and saw that during all 3 trimesters, pregnant women were at higher risk of hospitalization due to respiratory illness, but it was particularly pronounced in the 3rd trimester. The reasons why pregnant women are at increased risk are likely related to the physiological changes of pregnancy and the changes that occur in their immune system, their cardiac system, and their respiratory system. But this is also complicated by some of the concerns that women and their healthcare providers might have about treatment of influenza during pregnancy. So because there's limited data available on the fetal effects, there might be concerns from the mothers and reluctance to take treatment if it's prescribed, and reluctance on the part of some healthcare providers to prescribe treatment. So the objectives of this study were to describe the first 4 months of the 2009 H1N1 influenza illness among pregnant women in the United States. So we ask for all cases from the start of the outbreak in April, with symptom onset anytime before August 21st of 2009. And to also try and describe the impact that antiviral treatment timing had on the course of illness in these women. So a request was made to all of the state health departments and the 3 large metropolitan health departments in Chicago, New York City, and Washington, D.C. And we asked for them to report to CDC all cases of pandemic 2009 influenza that had happened in pregnant women that had been reported to the health department. So we didn't ask them to go out and actively identify any new cases, but asked that any cases that had been reported to them in the first 4 months of the outbreak, they intend report to CDC. We used the same definitions for confirmed and probable cases that were used throughout the outbreak response. And pregnant women meeting either of these definitions were included in this snapshot. We sent out an Excel spreadsheet to try and make it as simple as possible for health departments to report, because personnel and resources were stretched very thin by August. But what we asked for were some basic demographics: the gestational age that the women were at the time of symptom onset, when their illness onset occurred in time, some measures of severity, including whether or not they were hospitalized, whether or not they were admitted to an intensive care unit, whether or not they received mechanical ventilation, and if they died. For women who received treatment, we asked for what type of antiviral treatment they received and the timing of that treatment, asked for any underlying health conditions that they had in addition to pregnancy, and for women who delivered, their delivery outcome information. We analyzed the risk of severe outcomes by treatment timing and also the risk of ICU admission by both treatment timing and pregnancy trimester. So the request was made to 53 state and local health departments. 50 health departments were able to respond in a time frame that we were able to include and reported a total of 788 cases in pregnant women. 2 health departments among these 50 reported 0 cases. 11 health departments reported 1 case in a pregnant woman. And 37 health departments reported between 2 and 135 cases. 5 of these 37 health departments reported only hospitalized cases. And there were 3 health departments that reported 37% of the total cases that we had. and 92% of those from those three health departments were hospitalized. So we definitely recognize that the sample was skewed towards more severe cases among pregnant women, because that's who was being reported to the health departments and who they had information on. So some basic characteristics of these women. This first column is all 788 women. The next column is the 509 that were hospitalized. The next column is the 115 that were admitted to intensive care units. And the final column is the 30 pregnant women who died in this 4-month time frame and were reported. You can see that the median age was around 25 for all these categories, and each category to the right is a subset of the previous column. By trimester, we saw illness and severe illness in all trimesters of pregnancy, but definitely a skewing towards more severe disease in the third trimester of pregnancy. Overall, about half of the women had an underlying health condition that placed them at increased risk of influenza complications other than pregnancy. And as you move towards the more severe outcomes, that's much higher. 78% of those who died had an underlying health condition other than pregnancy. And treatment timing for the total sample was 2 days from the time of symptom onset until antiviral treatment was begun. But among the deaths, the median time was 6 days. For the 509 that were hospitalized, the median length of the hospital stay was 3 days, but it ranged from 1 day to 73 days. 25% of the hospitalized patients were admitted to ICU, and 19% were mechanically ventilated. We looked at antiviral treatment in three categories. Early treatment was women who received treatment within 2 days of their symptom onset, consistent with the CDC recommendations. Intermediate was women that received treatment between 3 and 4 days after symptom onset. And late treatment was those who received antivirals more than 4 days after symptom onset. We also looked at no treatment separately and did not collapse that with late treatment, because no treatment includes some people who maybe rapidly declined and died, but it also includes quite a number of people whose symptoms resolved, and so they didn't ever get to the point of someone prescribing treatment. As you can see, when we look at the entire group, with early treatment as our referent group, there's a suggestion of maybe a slight increased risk for those who got intermediate and late treatment, but really borderline statistical significance. When we look at risk of ICU admission, though, among those with different treatment timing, you can see those who had treatment 3 to 4 days after symptom onset were over twice as likely to be admitted to an ICU, and those who received treatment more than 4 days after symptom onset were 6 times as likely to be admitted to an ICU. For mechanical ventilation, those with treatment 3 to 4 days after symptom onset were about 4 times as likely to be mechanically ventilated as those with early treatment, and those with treatment more than 4 days after symptom onset about 12 times as likely to be mechanically ventilated. And for death, intermediate treatment had about a tenfold risk, and obviously for late treatment, this is very wide confidence interval, but what this represents is one of the 30 women who died received early treatment. Next, in an attempt to look at it by trimester as well, because one of the questions that kept coming up is there really a risk in first trimester? Is it necessary to be treating in first trimester? And is it necessary to vaccinate in the first trimester? And CDC recommendations do recommend both treatment and vaccination in all trimesters of pregnancy. But we used early treatment during any trimester of pregnancy as the referent group, and then looked at intermediate versus late treatment by trimester. And you see among those who received intermediate treatment, meaning 3 to 4 days after symptom onset, the increased risk of ICU admission was only present for the third trimester women. But for late treatment, so these are women who receive treatment more than 4 days after symptom onset, all three trimesters all three trimesters were at significantly increased risk of ICU admission. So it did appear that that risk was not unique to later in pregnancy. So everything I've showed you up until now is for April, see how we're doing on time, for April through August, and I'll just very briefly talk about the data for the last 4 months. CDC instituted a pregnancy flu line and asked for data just on ICU admissions and deaths. So this shows you the following 4 months. And so this first column here is what I showed you so far, the ICU admissions and death. The next column is what we've collected on the flu line for August through December, everything that was reported through the end of January. So a total of 280 pregnant women admitted to intensive care units, and a total of 56 deaths. So the 30 initial deaths, 26 additional deaths have come in through the flu line for 56 deaths total. And you can see in both time periods that while there does appear to be an increased risk in the third trimester, that deaths continue to occur in all three trimesters of pregnancy. So what we've seen is a continued disproportionate number of deaths in pregnant women. Pregnant women constitute about 1% of the US population, and they've been responsible for about 5% of the 2009 H1N1 influenza deaths that have been reported to CDC. And these data are consistent with other studies that have taken place in the US, as well as studies that have been reported from other parts of the world. We also found that delayed antiviral treatment was definitely associated with more severe illness and death. And our data also importantly suggest that while early treatment within 2 days of symptom onset is the best, there is still a benefit to beginning treatment 3 and 4 days after symptom onset compared to later. So it is important to get that message out also. The data supported the public health recommendations about antiviral treatment, but also help emphasize the importance of vaccinating pregnant women in any trimester of pregnancy. Okay. This presents a challenge since pregnant women have been very poor receivers of influenza vaccine in the past. And this shows you the different groups that are recommended to receive influenza vaccine each year, just for seasonal influenza vaccine. And this, this bottom line is pregnant women who typically hover at around 15 or 20% receiving the influenza vaccine. This is likely due to hesitancy on the part of the mothers, accessibility. OBGYNs are perhaps not the most frequent vaccination location because there's not a lot of vaccines offered to this population. Multiple factors that we need to address. So delayed treatment, many factors contributing on the part of healthcare providers, women, as well as the rapid tests appear to be a factor, with them having very low sensitivity and negative rapid tests may have led to delays in treatment. I think I'm gonna skip the rest of this to the conclusion. This is the most complete national picture that we have of 2009 H1N1 influenza in pregnant women, confirming they're disproportionately affected in terms of death and severe illness, and supports the ACIP recommendations. And I'd just like to acknowledge the many, many collaborators, particularly at the state and health, state and local health departments on this project. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peggy. Now we're gonna open it up for questions. Peggy, I had a question for you while we're waiting for people to come to the mics. In our branch, our job is to calculate how many pregnant women are indicated for influenza vaccination. We seem to have trouble making that calculation. Do you have any solutions to that problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a challenge. We have a number of denominator calculations that at any one point in time, about 1% of the US population is pregnant, but when you start summing that over time, people moving in and out of the pregnancy state, it gets complicated quickly. But there are a number of folks at CDC that are working on trying to come up with reasonable estimates for that.
Yeah, I'd like to hear how they're doing from time to time, and we've used different estimates from 4 million, the birth cohort, to 6.5 million to count all births or something like that, but then that we know that that's not really quite what we need, and we don't have any better way to do it.
Right. There's about 6 million pregnancies each year.
4 million births, and that figuring out those numbers and when to count people for different durations, but it still comes out reasonably close to 1%, but the numbers go up and down a little.
Question.
Yes, Philip Heine from Durham, North Carolina. Just a statement about pregnancy in general, and I think you hit it. It is a reluctance both on the provider and the patient's part, and I think it's our fault. And it's our fault because we're so concerned about the litigation in pregnancy, we send a mixed message to our population. And I'll use the HPV vaccine as an example. Really, based on theoretic benefit alone, or theoretic concerns alone, no evidence of concern in the studies, we put it out there that it should not be used in pregnant women. Well, if I were a pregnant patient, I would look at that and say, well, there must be something wrong with it. And so on all these drugs and vaccines, we put it out there, should only use if the benefit outweighs the risks. And I think we need to change how we articulate that to our population because we created this. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
No, I think those are very good points. And we certainly heard anecdotal reports at every step of the way of women not wanting to take treatment, of healthcare providers not wanting to prescribe, and then even heard an anecdotal report of a woman taking a prescription to a pharmacy and the pharmacist didn't want to fill it because of concerns about it being used during pregnancy. So I think there are many places we need to intervene to make our message more coherent and clear.
I have a question about the Indian health electronic system. How soon, what was the interval between vaccination and when you got the data entered into your electronic system?
Yeah, we actually, because most of our sites are using a point of service data entry electronic health record, basically the shot is given and it's administered usually that same day, and then we would get the data from most of our large sites every night. So it was actually very timely. We don't have the lag time that you have with systems that are using claims data. There are always a few outliers that are relying on the old system of transcribing in paper and then entering them, but those are fewer and fewer in the Indian Health Service.
Thank you. And the other question I had was, you mentioned that you had a participation rate of about 60%. What was the reasons that the other providers gave for not participating in your system?
We didn't actually ask specific reasons. The way we distribute the software is we put it out there, and then it's up to sites to choose to download it. Some of them just didn't have the technological capacity to have somebody on site to put the software in place. Others were completely overwhelmed and swamped with responding to H1N1, and they didn't respond. And then we had sites that aren't on the RPMS system, and so they weren't able to replicate our logic to send the data. So there were sort of a number of different factors. But we have taken a look at the sites that did not participate, and we don't think that there's anything unique about them that would bias our results.
Thank you.
Lona?
I have a question for you. Well, I was wondering about this business about the late treatment with antivirals in the hospital. Did you ask the providers what actually was going on there? Was it the same thing that the pregnant women didn't want to receive drugs, or was it that it wasn't realized that they had influenza infection, or why would it be delayed by 4 days?
Right. So we don't have that data on everyone, but we clearly have it on some cases, and I think we have all of those explanations. We have some pregnant women who were handed a prescription, left with it, and didn't fill it, and didn't take it. We have some women who reported to their healthcare provider's office, then to the emergency room, and then back to the emergency room, multiple encounters with the healthcare system without influenza being strongly suspected. And then by the time they came back to the emergency room, yet again, their oxygen saturation was very low, and they rapidly deteriorated, and we had quite a number of reports of emergency cesarean sections taking place in ICU units as well as emergency departments, which is pretty rare in the obstetric world. So I think having a high clinical suspicion for influenza is really important, and that's a message we need to get out. And ACOG was extremely helpful in getting that message out to obstetricians during the course of the outbreak. So just spreading that as widely as possible is key.
Question at the mic?
Yes, good afternoon. The study shows very clearly the benefit to the mother of antiviral treatment, and that's very supportive of the ACIP recommendation, but I'm an immunization person and unfamiliar with the work on antivirals and the risk to the fetus during pregnancy. Is that well studied? And, you know, if it is, then it should be relatively easy to communicate that by addressing, just providing the science to our physician partners.
Right. So unfortunately, antiviral medications, like most medications, are not well studied in pregnancy. So of the medications that were licensed in the last 20 years or so, there's not adequate information to determine the risk during pregnancy for over 90% of them. So antiviral medications are in a lot of good company. It's not a unique situation, but we don't have great data on it. They're a pregnancy category C drug, according to FDA, like most medications end up. Pregnant women are excluded from clinical trials that are done before marketing, so you're relying on post-marketing data and often inadvertent exposures to try and reach your conclusions. So you're trying to assess the risk versus benefit without a whole lot of good data on the risk. In this case, the risk to the mother was sufficiently severe that CDC was comfortable coming out with a recommendation that prompt antiviral treatment should be used. We want to do more detailed follow-up of the infants so that we will have better data in the future. A hospital in Texas, Parkland Hospital, recently published some data from a year ago's outbreak that was very reassuring, not showing really increased risk of any minor or major birth defects or other adverse birth outcomes among infants that were exposed in utero. So I think the data on infants is very reassuring, and most of what we've seen, even with the pandemic, the problems that the neonates have largely been related to prematurity. Moms are very, very sick, so these babies are being delivered very early, and they have all sorts of health complications, but there hasn't been anything that suggested it was specifically related to either the illness or the treatment.
Oh, very good. Well, thank you.
Andy Eisenberg in Sarasota, Florida. I would like to find out if you have any more information or are going to look into some of the phenomenon you mentioned of inappropriate testing with point of care testing and negative results, and then follow up with how much that may have delayed treatment, appropriate treatment, and then outcomes.
So the California Department of Health published a paper on pregnant women that some of us at CDC collaborated on a couple of months ago that looked specifically at the rapid testing issue. And among pregnant women, I think it was close to 50% initially had a negative rapid test. And certainly a lot of those women had delayed treatment. It's not as clear cut as being able to really say, yes, the negative rapid test led to delayed treatment, but that was certainly a message we were working hard to try and get out, is that it was important to treat without relying on the test results, and that the rapid tests really were not helpful in this context, other than perhaps a positive rapid test might be reassuring to a healthcare provider that they're on the right track. But I think there was certainly, you know, with a 10 to 70% sensitivity, there's a real danger in relying on those.
Were you able to collect any of that data that you can report on with the same database that you have here?
So for California, they had the data on the rapid tests, and that was in the first week of January in the New England Journal of Medicine. For the whole nation, we don't have that data, unfortunately.
Thanks.
I think we have time for one or two more.
I just make a comment about the rapid test kits. I think that it's important to know that the rapid test kits test about 40% of influenza-like illness cases positive in the middle of a season, just the same number you would get if you tested with PCR. So I don't think it's 10% sensitive. I don't think that might be true. 70% is probably more like it.
So 10 to 70 is what's up on the CDC website
right now. I know.
Well, I think we've run out of time. Thank you very much for your participation, and to the speakers.